been it for me for today. I'm DJ Firefly. You've been listening to Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. If you want to get in touch with me, or if you missed a show, feel free to check out my website at djfirefly.com.
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we recognize April 24th as the 110th anniversary of the Ottoman Empire's systematic plan to exterminate the Armenian race.
We hear part of our annual documentary titled It Was Genocide, Armenian Survivor Stories. Law and Disorder co-host Heidi Boghossian narrates this sound-rich documentary featuring rare stories of several adults who survived the Armenian genocide.
We then explore a current investigation into alleged discriminatory banking practices against Armenian Americans in the Los Angeles area. Our guest, Alex Rag Bastian, a member of the Armenian Bar Association Board of Governors and chair of its Armenian Rights Watch Committee, discusses unexpected bank account closures that raise concerns about potential ethnic or national origin-based profiling. Stay with us.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
Around the world, April 24th marks the observance of the Armenian Genocide. On that day in 1915, the Interior Minister of the Ottoman Empire ordered the arrest and hangings of Armenian intellectuals and community leaders in Constantinople. The date is widely considered to be the original beginning of a systematic and well-documented plan to eliminate the Armenians, who had been under Ottoman rule and treated as second-class citizens since the 15th century. The unspeakable and gruesome nature of the killings, beheadings of groups of babies, dismemberments, mass burnings, mass drownings, use of toxic gas, lethal injections, render oral histories particularly difficult. Why did this happen? Despite being deemed inferior to Turkish Muslims, the Armenian community had attained a prestigious position in the Ottoman Empire, and the central authorities there grew apprehensive of their power and their longing for a homeland. A concerted plan of deportation and extermination was allowed to be carried out, in large part, because World War I demanded the involvement and concern of potential allied countries. As the writer Grigoris Balakian wrote, the war provided the Turkish government, quote, their sole opportunity, one unprecedented, to exploit the chaos of war in order to effect their extermination plan. As Armenians escaped to several countries, including the United States, a number came to New Britain, Connecticut in 1892 to work in the factories of what was then known as the hardware capital of the world. By 1940, nearly 3,000 Armenians lived there in a tight-knit community.
Years has gone by, and they still have not acknowledged that this happened, and it was a genocide.
As a nation, how can they deny this? I mean, how can it be denied? It's a half of a population was removed.
I don't like Turks per se because of what they did to our people, but I do enjoy the culture.
Why would I grow up hating the Turks if she didn't tell us stories? Well, then we must have been told something that we hated the Turks.
Armenians had a lot of power, a lot of control. They were the merchants. They were people who, in essence, were major drivers of the economy and the world in Turkey.
Yeah, I think they were threatened by the culture. And the genocide started 1915, April 24, in Istanbul, where they took all the intelligentsia of the country and took them outside of the city and hanged them.
The overlay was, of course, religious, with Muslims, and they're the first country to acknowledge Christianity as a national religion. So, you know, there's a lot of history here with all of that.
The other thing that the Turks used to say, where is your Jesus now? Where is he? Why isn't he saving you? Well, they would say this on the death marches.
My brother Ernest was killed in an automobile accident. And his uncle came over to my house and said, hey, Ostian, where is your God now? And she cupped her ears and she said, Chilasim, Chilasim, I don't want to hear that. God gave him to me, and God took him away. How much more Christian could you be?
As you will hear from the stories of first-generation Armenian survivors who continue to live in New Britain, Connecticut, a shared history, a shared identity emerges. Some learned about the massacres directly from their parents or family members, while others were not told at all. Often, surviving women were ashamed to talk about what they had experienced, because so many of them had been raped or forced into harems. For others, conjuring up visual images of the atrocities was too painful to bear. When parents did speak about the crimes they experienced or witnessed, they frequently spoke in Turkish or Assyrian instead of English or Armenian, so that their children couldn't understand. Most children of survivors say that the subject was a secret, even forbidden.
My mother did not keep secrets from us. She spoke about the Turks. She hated the Turks. She made us hate the Turks. I remember as a teenager, I wanted to send away for Turhan Bey's picture in Hollywood. And he was a very handsome Turkish actor. We weren't allowed anyway. But the ones who did keep it secret were the ones who were ashamed of what happened. And I know for a fact, many of the older women, older than my mother, had gotten raped. Those are the ones, in my opinion, in this area, were the ones who kept it secret.
I grew up hearing, like the others, my mother didn't talk about it to me, ever. But I was a little girl, and my mother was quite a bit older than I was. She was older when I was born. And so her friends would come over, and they would sit and talk to each other. The next thing you know, they'd all start crying. And I would cry, too. And my mother would turn to me and say, why are you crying? And I'd say, because you're crying, and not knowing why I was crying.
And just recently, we found out that this one got raped, that one got raped, and this is why they couldn't talk about it. Now, I don't know about the men, why the men kept it secret, but as far as the women, Yes, you're right. The men were too young. But many of the women did get raped, and those are the ones, in my opinion, that really kept it a secret. And my mother told me many stories, so she wasn't ashamed. She didn't have that feeling of being ashamed.
In our house, it was a secret. And then you hear someone would be talking about something, and then as you approach, they say, Biji Oğlan, which means little boy, that's me. And everything would switch into Turkish, and everybody. And then, you know, some Armenians would come visit from Whitensville, and they'd sit in the living room. They're all talking Turkish. It was a forbidden thing to discuss.
I had heard these stories as I listened. I really heard these stories. And then the old country. They always talked about the old country. And I had no idea where it was. When I was a little girl, I thought the old country was like Tolland, Connecticut. And I just had no idea. But I always wanted to go there. And then I felt terrible because I never had a grandmother or a grandfather or an aunt, a real aunt or an uncle.
As children growing up, you know, friends would come to the house. Now, they would always speak Armenian, but whenever they had an off-color story to tell, and you could always tell it was an off-color story because of the way they broke into laughter, it was always told in Turkish or Assyrian. And then they'd revert back to English. So the stories were really not designed for children to hear. It was for them. But you could always tell by their laughter that something was going on, you know, that they didn't want us to know about. And in point of fact, that's what they always did. If there was something going on at the dinner table and they didn't want us to know what was going on, they'd speak Assyrian or Turkish to one another. So that whole business of speaking Turkish and the residual effects of the genocide were interesting, kind of almost juxtaposed one against the other.
Genocide has both physical and non-physical aspects, destroying the national culture of the oppressed group and imposing that of the oppressor. That was the theory of legal scholar Raphael Lemkin, who coined the word genocide in 1943 with the Turkish extermination of the Armenians in mind. While genocide is defined as the organized destruction, in whole or in part, of a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group, Lemkin wrote that a group need not be only physically exterminated to suffer genocide. Erasing a people's cultural identity through destruction of their language, religion, social, and political institutions, that too is genocide. The Armenian genocide, the very first of the 20th century, may be viewed in four distinct segments. The first segment began with the deportation and killing of the 250 intellectuals. Before that, in 1895, Ottoman suspicion of the Armenian population had led to the massacre of 300,000 Armenians by a special order of the government. In 1909, 30,000 more were slaughtered. The second segment involved the conscription of approximately 60,000 Armenian men into the General Turkish Army. They were later disarmed and killed by their Turkish counterparts. The third segment comprised of massacres, deportations, and death marches of women, children, and the elderly into the Syrian deserts. Hundreds of thousands were killed by Turkish soldiers, gendarmes, and Kurdish mobs. Others perished from famine, epidemic diseases, and exposure to the elements. Thousands of women and children were raped. Tens of thousands were forcibly converted to Islam. The final segment of the genocide is still ongoing and consists of the denial by the Turkish and United States governments that a genocide even occurred. Despite the body of documentation that exists, Turkey has launched a well-orchestrated and financed campaign of denial through inaccurate scholarship, propaganda, and extensive lobbying. Turkey even has a law which forbids mention of the word genocide.
Article 301 in Turkey essentially makes genocide an illegal word to use, a term. It's a denial. If you don't have the word, it doesn't exist. Genocide didn't exist. And so what you're doing is, in essence, is saying, if we don't recognize the word, if we don't use the word, then all mention, all concept of a genocide disappears. So what can you call it? Massacres? The first Holocaust? I mean, there are a lot of ways you can define it. they've chosen because it's genocide. And it truly was genocide. The issues are deep-seated. The conflicts were deep-seated. It's not only religious. It was control. It was economic. It was financial. Armenians had a lot of power, a lot of control. They were the merchants. They were people who, in essence, were major drivers of the economy and the world in Turkey.
Arthur Shevardian's father was orphaned and came to New Britain from what is today Iran, but that was in 1915 a part of the Ottoman Empire. Arthur teaches a component on the Armenian genocide for a local high school's course on the subject of genocide.
My father is Ashot Dmitri Shavardian, and that's the Armenian pronunciation, Shavardian, and my mother, Rose. The material for this particular conversation began several years ago at the request of a teacher at Avon High School who has a course called Genocide, Holocaust and Genocide. And he asked if I could come and share my family's story of the genocide with the students at Avon High School, their juniors and seniors. It really forced me to go back and do some reconstruction. We had bits and pieces, but had never really put the story together in any format. So I went back and found some documentation that my father had kept. I did some research, historical research as well. A lot of what we have is factual information because I have the original documentation. Some of it is put together from hearsay and then trying to create a story. And in those pieces that we don't know that I've created, I hope 2 + 2 becomes 4 and not 5. But it's close. It's close to the story. And the story begins, my father was born in 1903. He always said he was born in 1905. But when we look through the original documentation, it turns out he was baptized in 1903. So therefore, he couldn't have been born in 1905. Likely it had to do with presenting himself as a younger person to be able to latch on to another member of the family to come to the United States as part of the visa process.
As a second-generation Armenian, I too have pieced together the fragments of stories from my family. My grandfather was a medical student at a college in Carpet. He said he had to beg his older sister for the tuition, and when he walked down the street, people would point to him with awe as the person who was going to college. When the genocide started, he enlisted or was drafted into the army. He narrowly and with difficulty escaped and came to the United States. I don't know how, but he was proud of the fact that he didn't have to disguise himself as a woman, as other men did, in order to beg or borrow his way out of the country. Then, in 1918, when Armenia was granted independence, he went back. He said the persecutions not only still existed, but that they were worse than before, so the process of escaping was even more difficult the second time. Coming to this country with no language or professional skills, he got a job in the foundry. In a short time, a flying piece of hot metal burned out one eye. The genocide ruined his life in Armenia and also in the United States. He had sent to the orphanage in Greece for a wife. The Armenian Relief Society paid for sending my grandmother to the United States. But when she got to Ellis Island, they wouldn't let her off the ship because of a gray halo around the iris of one eye. Again, the Relief Society paid to send her to Cuba because entry from there was less stringent. They found her a family to stay with, 9 people in a one-room house with a dirt floor. They took her daily to a clinic for a nurse to put eye drops in her eye. After 6 months, the nurse told the doctor that there was no change, so she must not have had an active, dangerous condition. The doctor agreed. Now it was better for her to enter through Mexico. Her daughter, my aunt, helped tell this story and says how impressed she always was with the kindness of strangers throughout the process. Historic Armenia was located along the Mediterranean Sea, in what exists today as Turkey. It's also, according to the Book of Genesis, where Noah's Ark came to rest, the first nation to adopt Christianity in AD 301. Armenians lived for centuries in their own kingdoms until the Ottoman invasions in the 1200s, when they became second-class citizens. After World War I, the Independent Republic of Armenia existed for just 2 years, from 1918 to 1920, in a fragment of what had once been their homeland. While Armenians had been attacked often prior to the massacre of 1895, the later 1915 genocide had the specific goal of eradicating all traces of the ancient nation. With the outbreak of World War I, the Young Turk government wanted to save what remained of the weakened Ottoman Empire. It adopted a policy of pan-Turkism, the establishment of a vast Turkish empire comprised of all Turkish-speaking peoples of the Caucasus and Central Asia extending to China. The goal included the Turkification of all ethnic minorities of the empire. The Armenian population became the main obstacle toward realization of this policy. Although the decision to deport all Armenians from eastern Turkey had been adopted in late 1911, the Young Turks intentionally used World War I as a pretext for its implementation. Of the 3 million Armenians living in Turkey at that time, more than 1.5 million endured unimaginable atrocities, were slaughtered, raped, or forced into Muslim harems. Churches, which formed the religious and cultural backbone of their lives, were destroyed, while homes were burned, property confiscated, and families killed and separated forever. Lucy and Roxy, Araxi, Maljanian, and Mary Abrahamian are sisters. Together they recount their mother's story.
My name is Roxy Yesyan Maljanian. My mother came from the village of Ichme in Harput, Armenia, Turkey now. And I'm one of three sisters that are here present representing our family. And the family name was Pilibozhin. Kuyumjan was the deep name. And our mother was born in 1908. And she came here to America after the genocide. And as a little girl, she remembers quite a few things about 1915. And when my mother was in her late 60s, early 70s, she started writing her history in Armenian. And she wrote it in very colloquial Armenian. She was an Armenian school teacher here in New Britain, taught students after she got married and came here. And in her story, since it was in Armenian, my sisters and I translated it after her death. She wrote it in the last years of her life. And she remembered many things of her childhood. And we divided the story into three sections. And each sister took a third of it to translate it the best we can. We all read Armenian. Like I said, she did it simply so we can understand it. We knew some of the stories. She talked about them, her childhood in the orphanage. And she tell us the nice things, really, about the orphanage. As children, she was 7 years old until she was 18. She was in the orphanage. She remembers the groups of children who were all just like her. They had lots of fun because they were children. And they played games and sports. And they learned crafts in the orphanage. The German Protestant orphanage taught them crafts, handiwork. So they learned many things, reading and writing. So they were happy as much as possible because everybody was in the same situation. And she remained there until 18. And at 18... there were newspapers here in America looking for orphans in different orphanages. And if your name appeared on a list, the orphan director would send a letter to the person in America that we have this child in this orphanage. And they would write to the orphan, and the orphan would identify herself or himself. And in that way, they were able to get to America through a relative that was here. That's one way that people got at home. But at 18, you had to leave the orphanage. When she was 7, 1908 to 1915, she was 7 years old. Before she got to the orphanage, She remembers as a little girl, the Turkish people in the villages were all their neighbors, and they got along very good with their neighbors, and they had fun with them because they were all in the same community. Even though the majority in this village was Armenian, they had Turkish people living there too. The trouble started, the rumors start coming into the villages that things were happening, and their children. She was warned that if something happened, you know, you go with your aunts and uncles. Her mother had died when she was a child, and she was living with aunts in the village. And her father was already in America, so they lived with the aunts. The first one of the incidents she writes and talked about was she remembered the gathering of the men in the village, and the village of Ichime, the houses were low roof, and you can go on your roof and look at what's happening. And the church was right below the street that they lived on. And my sisters and I both, all three of us, have visited Ichime. And we took two trips to Ichime so we can kind of visualize what happened. The church was on the street below, and they remember the men being gathered and taken into that church and hollering, and they heard the screams. And the next thing, the church was being burned, and they remember the church being burned and screaming and the hollering of all the people dying in this building. And then she recalled going from house to house. They were starting to hide from things. And you can run on the rooftops in Ichme. They were flat roofs, close to each other. And you could jump, and you're 7, 8 years old. You jump from building to building. And they were able to jump to the next building and hide in the neighbor's house. So now they knew there was trouble. So you could go down to the next house and hide somehow. She remembered that. And then when the time came and they were coming into the village and they'd see more, maybe my sister Lucy can relate that part of the village. Do you remember them, the hiding, what the uncle told them to do?
When they came into the homes, they all had to gather whatever belongings they had to start the march. They told my mother, "We're going to hide our gold. It's going to be in this chest and come in the back, and we're going to hide it in the ground, but you never, ever tell anybody where it is." So all their gold coins and jewelry, they hid in the backyard, courtyard, wherever it was, and then they gathered them up and they started this horrific march.
During the genocide, the Allied powers, Great Britain, France, and Russia, responded to news reports by issuing a warning to Turkey. Quote, "The Allied governments announce publicly that they will hold all members of the Ottoman government, as well as such of their agents are as implicated, personally responsible for such matters." Such warning had no effect, however. After World War I, the young Turks in power resigned their government posts and fled to Germany, where they had been offered asylum. Turkey's new moderate government and the Allies asked repeatedly that Germany return the young Turks to stand trial at home. These requests were denied. Armenian activists located the young Turks and assassinated them, along with two other instigators of the mass murders. A new Republic of Armenia was formed. Representatives attended the Paris Peace Conference with hope that the victorious Allies would return their historic lands seized by Turkey. In response, the European allies asked the United States to assume guardianship of the new republic, something that President Woodrow Wilson wanted, but that Congress rejected. Thanks to Wilson's persistence, the Treaty of Sèvres was signed on August 10, 1920, recognizing an independent Armenian state in an area comprising much of the former historic homeland. But Turkish nationalism persisted. The moderate Turkish leaders who had signed the treaty were ousted in favor of a new national leader, Mustafa Kemal, who disavowed the treaty and reoccupied the lands in question. Surviving Armenians were expelled, including thousands of orphans. No allied power would come to the aid of the Armenian Republic, and it collapsed. Just a small portion of the easternmost area of historic Armenia survived as part of the Soviet Union. Some ask what the importance is of formally recognizing the Armenian genocide. One need only look at history for an answer. A young Adolf Hitler remarked on the tepid reaction of the world's power elites to the plight of the Armenians. After he achieved power in Germany, in 1939, Hitler decided to conquer Poland, telling his generals, quote, "Thus for the time being I have sent to the east only my death's head units, with the orders to kill without pity or mercy all men, women, and children of Polish race or language. Only in such a way will we win the vital space that we need. Who still talks nowadays about the Armenians?" In 2008, a group of Turkish intellectuals offered their apologies to the Armenian people in an online petition, available in 8 languages. The petition read, quote, "My conscience does not accept the insensitivity showed to and the denial of the great catastrophe that the Ottoman Armenians were subjected to in 1915. I reject this injustice, and for my share, I empathize with the feelings and pain of my Armenian brothers and sisters. I apologize to them." In the first 2 hours after launching the petition, over 5,000 people signed, including over 200 Turkish journalists, historians, scholars, musicians, and political scientists. Turkish media reported a sharp criticism of the initiative by the country's nationalist circles. A group of nearly 60 former ambassadors reportedly issued a joint statement warning that the started campaign was, quote, "fraught with negative consequences for national interests." While citizens of Turkey and Turks living in different countries around the world signed the petition, they nonetheless avoided using the word genocide, instead calling the events the Great Catastrophe.
This was done by design, by government design. That's what they're trying to deny, that it wasn't a design, but it was, because it was done so systematically. First the intelligentsia, then the villages and all the men, then leaving women and children. This and it was step by step by step.
They took doctors or the men, like you say, the intelligentsia, and that was the end. My mother-in-law told me that story. I remember very well. Then she had a brother, Zadeh, whom my husband was named after because he was a boy. They took him and they kidnapped him, and they don't what happened to him.
The Armenian identity is now a collective one, pieced together from historical documents and personal stories handed down from survivors to their children. The media did cover the events as they happened, and the U.S. ambassador to Turkey, Henry Morgenthau, told the Secretary of State in July 1915 that, quote, "a campaign of race extermination is in progress, under a pretext of reprisal against rebellion." On May 6, 1915, the New York Times reported that, quote, "the young Turks have adopted the policy of Sultan Abdulhamid, namely, the annihilation of the Armenians." That was an excerpt from the 90-minute special, It Was Genocide, Armenian Survivor Stories. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The Greater Los Angeles area is home to the largest Armenian population outside of Armenia, estimated at 500,000 people. For years, that community has faced instances of racism and discrimination, including a rise in anti-Armenian racism, known as Armenophobia. In 2022, leaked audio recordings revealed derogatory remarks by Los Angeles City Council members about Armenians, reflecting underlying biases within political institutions. Recently, the Armenian Bar Association, in collaboration with the City of Los Angeles, LA Civil and Human Rights and Equity Department, has launched an investigation into alleged discriminatory practices by banks in the Los Angeles area, where Armenian-American individuals and businesses have reported abrupt and unexplained closures of their bank accounts. These closures raise alarms about potential ethnic or national origin-based profiling, particularly considering ongoing geopolitical tensions in the South Caucasus. This troubling trend comes at a time when the U.S. government is considering a major financial arrangement with Azerbaijan. The Armenian Bar Association has issued a formal objection to a proposed $100 million loan or financial guarantee to Azerbaijan under the authority of the Export-Import Bank Act of 1945. The Bar Association argues that such financial support would not only contradict U.S. human rights values, but could also embolden a regime with a well-documented history of aggression against Armenia and the indigenous Armenians of Artsakh or Nagorno-Karabakh, many of whom have recently been displaced. The Bar Association's efforts reflect broader concerns about the security and civil rights of Armenian Americans at home, as well as U.S. foreign policy decisions that may have far-reaching consequences abroad. We're joined today by Alex Harag-Bastian, a member of the Armenian Bar Association's Board of Governors and chair of its Armenian Rights Watch Committee. Alex, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Maria, Steve, thank you so much for having me.
What prompted the Armenian Bar Association to join the efforts of LA's Civil and Human Rights and Equity Department to begin investigating discriminatory bank account closures in the Los Angeles area?
Well, Maria, our community has been experiencing a lot of hardship for a long time. But really what caused red flags were more recent substantiated claims of Citigroup significantly discriminating against Armenian Americans. And we all know that economic discrimination can really impact a community. And the findings were actually alarming because what was occurring was so out in the open and so blatant, where Armenian Americans were unable to have the same experiences as other members of our community. And that's very clearly unconstitutional, but it's also an unfortunate example of what occurs when certain communities are treated this way. And, you know, we have had, unfortunately, other examples of, you know, hate crimes and incidents that are discriminatory in nature. In San Francisco, for example, the church that I was baptized in was firebombed in a hate crime in 2020. The elementary school, the Armenian school, someone put a bullet hole through the sign of the school, also a hate incident and a hate crime in 2020. Unfortunately, these incidents don't get the same level of attention and scrutiny and response as perhaps incidents in other places. And we saw something very similar when we looked at what Citigroup was doing to Armenian Americans. And fortunately, what we saw was a federal agency, the Consumer Bureau Protection Agency in Washington, D.C., that really kind of took it on and fined Citigroup extensively because of the sheer blatant nature of the discrimination, right? Shutting down people's bank accounts, not giving people opportunities to take loans. And we know that in our community, this is something that was more widespread than what Citigroup was experiencing and what the customers at Citigroup were experiencing, I should say. And what we did is we started fielding calls. We did a public service announcement, and the response was overwhelming. So many other individuals from our community were experiencing challenges from other banking institutions as well. And so when we learned about what the city of LA is doing, we immediately wanted to partner because it's so important to give the public and our community in particular an avenue and to really find a way to deal with these unconstitutional actions that we're experiencing.
Alex, would you put this example of discrimination in bank accounts in Los Angeles into a broader context of the nature of discrimination against Armenians in the United States? Frankly, we don't hear a lot about that. I don't know if that's a media question or a political question, but what has been the nature of hate crimes and discrimination against the Armenian community historically in the United States?
Steve, thank you so much for that question, because even more so than the United States, before getting into discrimination here, I think it's important to note what Armenians have experienced worldwide. And the most glaring example of that is really the Armenian genocide that occurred in 1915 onwards. And the callous nature of how the world kind of dealt with that issue even after the genocide, where Armenians were expected to basically, you know, brush themselves aside and move on. When Armenians started coming here in large numbers after the genocide, they really took roots in Fresno, first and foremost. And the experiences of Armenian Americans then, I think, really speak to glaring discrimination against Armenians. In fact, a lot of people don't know this, but Armenians were not allowed to own homes due to many covenants. They actually initially had to also drink from certain water fountains, no different than other people of color. They were basically treated as second, sometimes third class citizens. And, you know, eventually what ended up happening in Fresno is Armenians really doubled down, worked hard, and found a way to persevere. And today, that community has a lot of ownership over the land in that area. But unfortunately, Fresno is not the only example. And throughout California, we experienced a variety of hardships based on discrimination, based on Armenophobia. But, you know, our community, we love the United States. We love being American. We love the fabric of being American. It's just at the end of the day, we are no different than anyone else. We also deserve equal protection under the law. And unfortunately, what seems to occur is we're in this weird place where we're often not really given the same attention as others. And when the discrimination or when the hate, when the examples of callousness occur to our community, there doesn't seem to be the same outcry. There doesn't seem to be the same support. And there's no better example more recently than the findings against Citigroup, where the discrimination against Armenians was so out in the open and so blatant. In fact, if that occurred to any other group of people, you would have seen a widespread outrage over it. And this is important to notice, because if they're doing this against Armenian Americans, they can do this against other people too. When it comes to hate, when it comes to hate crimes, and when it comes to economic discrimination, it's not just something that impacts one of us. It actually impacts all of us. And we're all due the same protections under the law and the Constitution.
Well, Alex, can you describe the nature of these recent complaints that you've received regarding bank and loan applications? And are they affecting individuals, businesses, or both?
Thank you so much, Maria. They are impacting both individuals and businesses. And what's so deplorable about this is the discrimination is happening based what appears to be Armenian last names and geography, where Glendale is really our home away from home, if you will. For me, it feels like home. For me, it is my home. I'm very proud to be American. I'm also very proud to be of Armenian descent. And Glendale really speaks to both, right? It's in the United States. I love the United States. It's my home. I'm American through and through. But it has an Armenian flavor to it, because a third, maybe 40%, even some will say, of the residents happen to be of Armenian descent. And so when you have examples of banking institutions discriminating against people based on their names and based on where they live, that is very alarming. I mean, can we just imagine for a second if we all close our eyes and change Armenian to any other racial or ethnic group? We would be appalled by that. These are unfortunately substantiated claims that we saw in the findings against Citigroup. What shocked us was how many other examples came to light as it relates to other banking institutions.
Alex, give us a demographic sense of the Armenian community. across the country, in California, and particularly in Los Angeles. How many Armenians live across the country in our state and here? And what kind of economic footprint has the community had in all of these regions?
Most definitely, Steve. Armenian Americans are really a group of people that don't always follow through on the census. Let me start by saying that. And so estimates vary, and we have seen two big waves of immigrant communities, whether it be in the 80s and 90s from the Middle East, or whether it be the 90s and the 2000s from the former Soviet Union, of Armenians really coming to the United States more recently. And if we had to put a number on it, I would say that LA County is home to roughly 500,000 Armenian Americans. When we look at the country in its totality, I would say over a million Armenian Americans live in this country. We have, of course, like with any community, a wide cross-section of people with different thoughts, different opinions. And really what's important about our community is we're very passionate about not only living in this country and being American, but we're also very passionate about issues that impact all other communities. What I think is unique about us is I would like to think of Armenian Americans as swing voters. They look at issues based on their life experiences, but they also look at it through the lens of business. Many Armenian Americans have become very successful at opening up their own business. And so that American dream is alive in us. We love the idea of America. That being said, however, it's important that we also kind of are part of discourse of America. And so LA County is really, for us, the heartland of that Armenian American experience, because not only is it the biggest diaspora community outside of Armenia, it is also kind of a perfect example of the diaspora of Armenians in general, because we actually have Armenians from, I would say, over 80 countries that reside in LA County today, right? We have had a diaspora for such a long time. It started voluntarily during the Silk Road. Armenians were throughout Asia and Europe and Africa, and they really kind of made a living being the bridge, if you will, between these different continents. But subsequently, due to hardships, due to massacres, and then due to the genocide, and subsequently due to war and the collapse of the Soviet Union, Armenians involuntarily developed a diaspora. And they're everywhere in the world, but LA County is the biggest diaspora community, and it really consists of Armenians that come from over 80 countries.
Well, what are the possible legal or civil rights violations involved in the bank account closures we've been talking about? And how are you pursuing accountability?
Well, that's a great question, because we all have a right under the law to equal protection. And discrimination is wrong across the board in all forms. With these banking institutions, unfortunately, the reality is the only way they understand that what they're doing is wrong is if there's a cost attached to that wrong. They need to be punished financially. And when you look at what happened with Citigroup, they were fined a substantive amount of money. And when we look at some of these other examples that we've heard about, again, it's going to be incumbent on us as a community, but also incumbent on government to really hold these banking institutions accountable, right? You cannot paint a broad brush on a community. You cannot discriminate people based on a name you may find funny sounding or based on an appearance that you don't like. These are not acceptable in the 21st century, nor should they have ever been acceptable to begin with. And so what we need to do is we need to really find a way to hold these banking institutions accountable where it costs them a lot of money when they engage in discrimination. And, you know, that's something that we're focused on. Because at the end of the day, we want banking to thrive also, right? We just want banking to be done constitutionally. We want banking to be done equally. We want Armenian Americans to also have the same abilities as anyone else to really chase the American dream, right? It shouldn't be that Armenians have to be twice or three times as good as others in business to have the same economic opportunities. Armenians shouldn't be a force to have this big boulder attached to them when it comes to the chase that is the American dream, right? We should have the same opportunities as everyone else because we love this country just like everyone else. In some cases, even more so. We love America so much. But we just need to have the same opportunities given to us as others have. And the only way to remedy this behavior is to hold banking institutions accountable and to have a cost attached to their malfeasance.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Steve Rohde. Today I'm joined by co-host Maria Hall. And we are joined by Alex Harag-Bastian, a member of the Armenian Bar Association Board of Governors and chair of its Armenian Rights Watch Committee. Alex, let's turn to another aspect of this. I understand the Armenian Bar Association opposes the proposed $100 million financial package to Azerbaijan. And what are the risks if that allocation goes through?
Steve, thank you so much for that question. I think it's important to note as a starting point that we're American and we're very passionate about the United States. We also are very passionate about rights, Armenian rights, really, across the globe. And often those two things are very much one and the same in that we look at our country's foreign policy. We want the best for our country. We want the best for the United States. We love being American. And some of the issues that we're seeing as it relates to Armenians in Armenia and worldwide are very jarring and concerning. We think that it's in America's best interests to uphold human rights. And we think that in order for there to be stability in that region, which is so important for the well-being of our country here in the United States, we think that the United States should hold the line as it relates to human rights, as it relates to stability, and as it relates to balance in the region. And unfortunately, Azerbaijan, at this current moment in time, has shown time and time again that it will engage in violations of human rights. In fact, currently, there are many Armenians that are being held in jail in Azerbaijan that should be released. They are being held as political prisoners with impunity, really, by the government of Azerbaijan. Unfortunately, currently, Azerbaijan has its military forces within Armenia, kind of as a leverage point and kind of as a hostage situation. Unfortunately, Azerbaijan's government is engaging in a variety of fraudulent activity when it comes to the discourse that is a peace settlement in the region. And what we really need to do as the United States is be an honest power broker there, right? We want peace, right, in the world. We want peace in America. First and foremost, this is about the United States of America, right? We love this country. But in order for us to find a way to really balance the region, we need to find a way to be just there as well. And the only way to engage in that is through the lens of righteousness, humanity, and really kind of finding a way to do that requires us to be honest with the situation. And so this $100 million loan, whether it be military aid or anything else for that matter to Azerbaijan, will only serve to perpetuate the conflict. It rewards bad behavior, especially at this juncture and moment in time where that country is unjustly incarcerating Armenians and really kind of holding Armenian territory hostage in an effort to gain additional leverage. And what we should do is as reasonable people is we should just incentivize peace, incentivize good behavior, because peace around the world is so good for the United States of America.
The Armenian Bar Association has issued a formal objection to a proposed $100 million loan or financial guarantee to Azerbaijan under the authority of the Export-Import Bank Act of 1945. Please describe the objection.
Well, as Armenian Americans, we're very sensitive to the fact that Armenia is in a precarious situation. It is on the brink of destruction. And what we're very sensitive about is our country here, the United States of America, putting the finger on the scale when it comes to military armaments and any kind of aid that may crush one side of the situation here, specifically Armenia. And what we've noticed is that this loan that Azerbaijan is seeking will actually help them in securing military armaments in order to continue their unjust occupation of Armenian lands and their eventual desire to really perhaps crush Armenia altogether. And that's not good foreign policy for our country, nor is it something that Armenian Americans want. And so we want justice, we want fairness, and we want peace. What we are really concerned about is that the loan is really driven to obtain aircraft that is going to be used for military purposes. And that really is designed to bring in weapons to the country for them to be used against Armenia and Armenians.
Alex, this has been such an illuminating conversation, and our time is coming to an end. How do these domestic and international developments intersect for the Armenian-American community? And what steps can community members take if they believe their accounts have been closed due to discrimination? And what role can our federal and state regulators play, and our listeners as well?
Well, Steve, thank you so much for all you are doing to help really shed light on the situation. For us, it all intersects because as Armenian Americans, we're very proud to be American, but we're also very proud of our identity as Armenians. And the United States is a melting pot. It's a gumbo of sorts of different flavors and tastes. And our taste, I think, is part of that gumbo. And I think that we do add a lot of value to this country, and we're very proud to do so. And whether it be the discussion today around economic discrimination, or whether it be the issues impacting Armenia and Armenians worldwide, we are very alert to all of this, and we want to be able to be a part of the fabric of this country. And so when we talk about next steps, it's so important that whether something is impacting you as it relates to banking or economic discrimination, for you to call the Armenian Bar Association, reach out to us, or call really LA, the Human Rights Office of LA, because these matters are taken seriously. We may or may not be able to reach a place with your complaint that may be actionable, but we need to keep proper documentation of these incidents too. And it's so important for all of us to work together. And it's not just for Armenians, by the way, because again, as I said earlier, when these incidents occur, they're not only impacting the Armenian community, they're impacting all of us as Americans, and the Constitution is sacred.
Alex, could you give our listeners the website of the Armenian Bar Association?
Steve, thank you so much. The place to really reach out to is the arwc@armenianbar.org email address. Once again, that's arwc@armenianbar.org. And please reach out to us anytime. Someone will respond within a business day.
Alex Harag-Bastian, member of the Armenian Bar Association's Board of Governors and chair of the Armenian Rights Watch Committee, thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder today.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you to both of you for all you do for our community.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for kids, teens, or young adults. It's just not.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals and volatile organic compounds into your body.
And nicotine, the same highly addictive substance found in regular cigarettes.
Nicotine can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
Affecting learning, memory, attention, and impulse control. And priming the brain for other addictions.
Vaping products also come in kid-friendly flavors that can make them appealing to youth.
And many kids also use other drugs, like marijuana, in vaping devices.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media,
many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping, because when you talk, they hear you.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
The future depends on teachers. Every day, teachers are shaping our tomorrows, starting their students on journeys that will change the course of history. Right now, in a classroom somewhere in the United States, there's a teacher inspiring a future scientist who will make preventing pandemics their life's work, sharpening the mind of an aspiring environmentalist who will help combat climate change, and generating possibilities for a student who will be the first in their family to graduate college. It all starts with teachers who meet challenges with creativity, who reinvent education for the future, who work towards a school system that lifts up every child, regardless of race, income, or zip code, and who enable the full potential of our students, our communities, and our country.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This is sending a terrible message across Milwaukee and across the country that ICE officials and FBI could just show up to a court and, using an administrative warrant, attempt to disrupt due process. The message that this is sending to immigrants on any sort of visa status is terrible.
The Trump administration escalates attacks on judges and immigrants. On Friday, FBI agents arrested Milwaukee County Judge Hannah Dugan on charges of obstructing justice and concealing an immigrant from arrest as federal agents waited in the courthouse hallway. We'll speak with two people who know the judge well. But first, three U.S. citizen children were deported Friday, including a four-year-old boy with fourth-stage cancer who was actively receiving treatment here, but was deported with his mother and seven-year-old sister. Another two-year-old was deported with her mother. We'll get the latest. Then Martin O'Malley, former head of the Social Security Administration, has issued a dire warning that Social Security could collapse due to sweeping Trump cuts.
Elon Musk, keep your hands off of Social Security.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 68 African migrants have been killed in a U.S. airstrike in Yemen. Houthi media outlets report the U.S. bombed a detention center in the western province of Sada. Another 47 migrants were injured in the attack. A separate U.S. attack killed at least 8 people in the capital, Sana'a. The Pentagon says it's carried out 800 strikes on Yemen since March 15th after Houthi fighters vowed to resume targeting ships in the Red Sea in an attempt to pressure Israel to end its war and blockade on Gaza. In Gaza, Israeli attacks have killed 23 Palestinians so far today after Israel forces killed at least 53 people Sunday, including six who were killed when Israel bombed a cafe near the Nusayrat and Burej refugee camps. Meanwhile, the World Food Program's announced it's run out of food to distribute in Gaza due to Israel's two-month-long blockade. Earlier today, the International Court of Justice began a five-day hearing on Israel's obligations to provide aid to Gaza. Palestinian envoy Amar Hijazi accused Israel of using humanitarian aid as weapons of war.
That's really the heart of why Palestine and over 40 other states are addressing the court today. It is not about the number of aid trucks Israel is or is not allowing into the occupied Palestinian territory, especially Gaza. It is not about Israel destroying the it is about Israel destroying the fundamentals of life in Palestine while it blocks UN and other humanitarians from providing life-saving aid to the population. It is about Israel unraveling fundamental principles of international law, including their obligations under the UN Charter. It is about Israel turning Palestine, and particularly Gaza, into a mass grave for Palestinians and those coming to their aid.
On Sunday, Israeli fighter jets bombed Beirut's southern suburbs again. The UN and Lebanese officials condemned the strike, with Lebanon's president warning Israel's actions are undermining stability in the region. In Canada, police have charged a man with murder for the car ramming death of 11 people during a music festival in Vancouver Saturday evening. It took place during the annual Lapu-Lapu festivities, which celebrate the Filipino community and culture. The victims ranged in age from 5 to 65. Dozens were wounded. This is a local community member.
It's kind of like you can be strong and weak at the same time. And you know, the efforts with gathering with not just the Filipino community, but everybody. And if you've been to a Filipino event or organizer, there is a saying called Isang Baksak. And it means when one falls, we all fall. But again, when one rises, we all rise.
No motive for the mass killing has been identified, but authorities say the suspect, 30-year-old Kaiji Adam Lowe, has a history of mental health-related interactions with Vancouver police. The tragedy came just 2 days ahead of high-stakes snap elections in Canada. Voters today will decide between the ruling Liberal Party, now led by Justin Trudeau's successor, Prime Minister Mark Carney, and Pierre Poilievre, who leads the Conservatives. He had been leading in the polls when Trudeau stepped down in January, but Carney's defiant response to Trump's tariffs and his threats to annex Canada have helped propel the Liberals' chances of staying in power. On Saturday, hundreds of thousands of mourners gathered at the Vatican for the funeral of Pope Francis, who died last week at the age of 88. During the eulogy, Cardinal Giovanni Battista remembered Pope Francis as a pope of the people and a peacemaker.
Di fronte all'infuriare di tante guerre di questi anni,
faced with the raging wars of recent years, with their inhuman horrors and countless deaths and destruction, Pope Francis insistently raised his voice, imploring peace and calling for reason and honest negotiation to find possible solutions. War, he said, is only the death of people and the destruction of homes, hospitals, and schools.
More than 50 world leaders attended the Pope's funeral, including President Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. The two met at the Vatican prior to the funeral. The meeting came a day after Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, met with Russian President Vladimir Putin at the Kremlin. On Sunday, Trump expressed disappointment with Putin for continuing to attack Ukraine while refusing to agree to a U.S. broker deal to end the war in Ukraine. Earlier today, Putin announced a unilateral three-day ceasefire in Ukraine beginning May 8th. On Sunday, Russia fired nearly 150 drones at Ukraine, killing at least four people. Meanwhile, North Korea has confirmed for the first time it had sent combat troops to fight alongside Russian forces. The Trump administration's escalating its attack on judges. On Friday, FBI agents arrested a county judge in Milwaukee, Hannah Dugan, who was charged with obstruction and concealing an individual from arrest. The FBI accused her of allegedly helping an undocumented immigrant avoid arrest inside a Wisconsin courthouse. The judge's arrest was widely criticized. Wisconsin Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin said, quote, "This action fits into the deeply concerning pattern of this president's lawless behavior and undermining courts and Congress's checks on his power," unquote. The FBI director, Kash Patel, is facing accusations he broke DOJ policy by posting a photo online of Judge Dugan in handcuffs. On Saturday, protesters rallied in Milwaukee to protest the Trump administration's crackdown on immigrants and the arrest of Judge Dugan.